Welcome once again to Word on the Hills with me, Felicity Sidnell-Reed, my co-host, Gwyn Scheldamer, and our guests this week, members of Brian Mullally's family. Each week, we visit with local authors or others involved with writing, like editors and publishers. This week, several of Brian Mullally's family have agreed to help us make a memorial program for Brian, who sadly died on July 18th. Perhaps they will tell us what started Brian on his writing career and what prompted him to keep going, writing well over 100 short stories, as well as 2 novels and a considerable amount of non-fiction. They will read us some of his work and perhaps some of the pieces written about him. We're very pleased to have Brian's wife Maureen, as well as Guy, Toby and Terry, 3 of his sons, with us today. Welcome to you all. Brian Mullally was a well-known Coburg writer who lived in Northumberland County with his wife, artist Maureen Mullally, for over 50 years. They brought up their 5 children in this area and for many years worked as a team in real estate. Brian was a prolific author and always had several projects on the go. He was cherished by his family and friends for his kindness and generosity of spirit. He loved to discuss the process of writing, the writing of others, and his own, and he was the leader of the critique group Pollard Writers for more than 20 years. So, Maureen, maybe we can begin by asking how Brian came to take up writing quite late in life. What prompted him to do that, and how did it all start?
You ask me how Brian started writing, and I started writing some words, putting it down what I thought would be appropriate. And then I found in Brian's computer, in his own words, how he started writing. So I thought I'd like to read you that instead. And here it is. When I was about 13, I started writing unfinished stories in a bundle of dog-eared exercise books I kept in a drawer. They were all lost when our home was destroyed during the Blitz. And it was not until my father died many years later that I thought about writing again. I came across my Mullally grandparents' wedding certificate from 1886. It was in pretty bad shape, but the tattered document afforded a tiny window into my father's family history. We were the first generation to spend our lives in Canada. Our ancestors had lived in England for generations, so the answers we sought had to come across the Atlantic by mail. I gathered up clues about our ancestors and presented my children with charts. And I was surprised by their response. It seemed to provide little interest at the time. So in an effort to make our ancestors' lives more interesting, I decided to write a series of stories, using the basic facts as background, taking note of their historical events and colouring their lives with my imagination. 20 years ago, I put these stories aside and began writing fiction in earnest. When you read between the lines in the work of writers, you discover how much of their personal life has been revealed.
Can you tell us a little about Kinship of Blood? I know this is a partly fictional story about your family, Maureen, and that it is very difficult to separate the fictional from the non-fictional.
Well, as Brian just described about how he began writing, Kinship of Blood became the title of the stories about our ancestors, which covers both sides of our family, going back well over 300 years, revealing some very colourful characters.
Brian loved writing short stories. Do you know why he especially liked this form?
Brian especially liked to write short stories because he had so many diverse ideas and so many characters to write about.
Tell us about some of your favourite stories.
A lot of his stories were based on fact. One of my favourites is An Insignificant Flower, about a Dr. Bernardo boy or home child, child immigrants brought to Canada in the 19th century. And another is A Patch of Blue, which is the title of one of his books. It's a real estate story about a family feud.
This is Toby reading excerpt from one of Brian's recent stories.
Owen Davies and I go back a long way. We both started school on the same day. I don't really remember Owen on that first day, but he says he does. I definitely remember the day he volunteered to play the female lead in the school pantomime. We laughed loud. Miss Sharp had to bang her pointer on the desk to bring the class back to order. I thought Owen was joking at first. I mean, what self-respecting 9-year-old boy would willingly put on a girl's dress and parade around in front of his classmates? By tradition, Miss Sharp's class produced the play for the school Christmas party. That particular year, she chose The Princess and the Pirate. I look back on 1937 of one of my better school years. It was the only year I was teacher's pet. Naturally, I was picked to play the pirate, and Jamie Romack was my understudy. My best friend, Bobby Sitwell, played the doctor. Soppy Jones was prime minister. I forgot who played the king. When Miss Sharp called for a volunteer to play the princess, no one moved a muscle. Some of us held our breath. Even when she explained how important the role was to the production of the play, no one took the bait. It was only when she described how the princess would be on stage the entire length of the play that Owen raised a limp hand. At playtime, Owen was surrounded by a group of jeering boys. "Here comes little Miss Davies," cried one. "Make way for Her Royal Highness Owenness," scoffed another. The school bully pushed his way through the crowd. "Let's sling him over the wall into the girls' playground," he yelled, grabbing Owen by the collar. "Yeah, let's," chorused his cronies. "Not on my watch," said a husky female voice. All heads turned to watch Miss Sharp approach. "Break it up, you little beasts," she ordered, brushing the cigarette ash from her navy blue vest. It was the one with the brass buttons, and it made her bosom stand out like the figurehead on an old-fashioned sailing ship. She placed her hands on hips, narrowed her eyes against the smoke from the cigarette dangling between her lips, and tapped one foot and waited for the boys to disperse. Miss Sharp was fond of using navy terms, and she had been known on more than one occasion to perform the sailor's hornpipe at school Christmas parties. I am sure if the education department had permitted slacks for females in those far-off days, she would have worn bell-bottom trousers. Owen never said a word. He just kept on grinning like a demented Cheshire cat. When I broke the news that evening at the family dinner table, the response fell somewhat short of my expectations, like finding your biggest firecracker had turned out to be a dud. However, there was no turning back. When I asked my mother if she could turn my dad's old striped pajamas into a pair of pirate breeches, she put down the Woman's Own magazine with reluctance, then stared at me in open-mouthed astonishment. "There's no way I'm letting you parade around in your father's pajamas, my lad." I tried a different tack, suggesting we ask our neighbor, Mrs. Sandler, to shorten the legs for me. Mom scowled and ordered me to stop talking with my mouth full. I sighed and tried to think up a new strategy. It was obvious my father's nether garments could not be exposed to public view. I tried wheedling and pleading. I even shed a few crocodile tears. Nothing worked. My mom just kept her head buried in her stupid old magazine. My grandmother proved to be equally uncooperative when I asked her if I could borrow her three-cornered hat, the plum-colored one she wore to chapel on Sundays. "You see," I explained, "if we take off the veil and feather, it would make a super buccaneer's hat." Granny sat speechless for a moment, a rare thing in itself. Then her face turned bright pink and her earrings began to jiggle with indignation. Eventually, she recovered her voice and announced she was absolutely mortified at the very idea. I turned to my father in desperation. "Could you help me make a wooden sword, Dad?" Until that moment, my father had managed to remain isolated from the discussion, his eyes moving back and forth between his supper plate and the sports page of the evening newspaper. I cleared my throat and repeated my request. The seconds ticked by on leaden boots. Finally, he raised his pale blue eyes and stared at me as he continued to chew on a mouthful of cold meat. I waited for his answer patiently as I could, careful not to fidget. Dad always took forever to eat his meals. Finally, he swallowed and addressed me. "Is this play part of the official school program?" he asked, prodding a weary Brussels sprout with his fork. Absolutely, Dad, I replied eagerly. If it goes over real well at the Christmas party, Miss Sharp says we can do it again on Parents' Night. My father abandoned the sprout and selected a piece of baked potato. I counted under my breath as he resumed chewing. On the count of 50, he swallowed and put down his fork, like a judge laying down his gavel. Since the school is putting on the play, it's up to the authorities to provide everything that's needed. That's exactly what I told him, my mother interjected, with a note of triumph in her voice. It's nothing short of an imposition, asking parents to provide stuff like that in these hard times. The other parents aren't complaining, I said, and immediately regretted my words when my father interjected. I don't give a fiddler's fart about the other families, he said, waving aside my mother's half-hearted objections to his vulgar expression with a terse, Quiet, woman! He turned a resentful red face back to me. Maybe they're better off than us and can afford to pay for this kind of tomfoolery. It's not tomfoolery, I said, pulling back quickly to avoid the anticipated cuff, only to step on my mother's foot. She had risen from the table to clear away the dishes. Mum pushed me away angrily as she rubbed the instep against her calf. Why don't you look where you're putting your feet, you clumsy boy? I knew the battle was lost. Somehow the situation had evolved into one of those rare occasions when all my elders' points of view coincided. Further discussion was pointless, so I gave them my best martyred look and left the kitchen. And that was how I became understudy to Jamie Romack.
Thank you to you all. Now we'll take a short break.